Chapter 65. A crisp breeze rippled across the lower slopes of Burkhan Khaldun, snapping taut the multitude of blue and red Mongolian state flags fluttering high overhead. The largest of the flags, a mammoth banner 50 feet wide, wavered above a large granite mausoleum whose carved facade had been hastily completed by local craftsmen just days before. The empty mausoleum was surrounded by a large crowd of dignitaries, VIPs, and news reporters who talked quietly among themselves while waiting for the future occupant to arrive. A rush of excited whispers swirled through the crowd, then all fell silent as the sound of marching boots drew near. A company of Mongolian army soldiers appeared through the pines, marching up a slight incline toward the waiting assembly. They were the first in a long procession of military honor guards escorting the remains of Genghis Khan to his final resting place. Genghis had been engaged in a battle siege near Yinchuan in northwest China when he'd fallen off his horse and died a few days later from his injuries. A secret funeral procession had brought his body back to Mongolia and the slopes of Burkhan Khaldun for burial in 1227, but history doesn't record the details of the cortege. Desiring to keep their enemies unaware of his death, as well as keep his burial spot secret for all eternity, his warrior comrades likely returned his casket in a nondescript, perhaps even covert procession, before burying him in an unmarked location. Nearly 8 centuries later, there would be nothing covert about his reburial. The Mongol warrior's body had lain in state in Ulaanbaatar for a week, drawing visits from over 2 million people, incredibly more than two-thirds the population of the entire country. Pilgrimages from all corners of the country were made by the thousands to lay eyes on his coffin. A 3-day funeral procession to his grave site in the Khenti Mountains drew an equally impressive number of well-wishers who lined the route holding flags and images of the ancient leader. Women and children waved and cried when the caisson rolled by, as if it was a favored relative who had just passed away. A national day of mourning and future holiday of remembrance marked the third leg of the procession. On this day, the caravan climbed up a makeshift road to a peaceful spot near the base of Burkhan Khaldun, where the warlord was said to have been born. Pitt, Giordino, and Gunn, with Teresa and Wofford alongside, sat in the front row of dignitaries, just a few seats down from Mongolia's president and parliament leaders. Pitt turned and winked at a young boy seated behind him as the funeral procession drew near. Noyan and his parents, special guests of Pitt's, looked on at the surroundings with awe, the boy's eyes widening in wonder as the Khan's caisson finally appeared. In a splendor worthy of the greatest conqueror the world has ever known, Genghis Khan's body was carried on a mammoth wooden caisson painted bright yellow. A magnificent team of 8 snow-white stallions pulled the funeral cart, seemingly dropping their hooves in perfect unison. Atop the caisson was the granite tomb Pitt had saved from the floodwaters, now covered in fresh lotus blossoms. A troop of aged lamas wearing bright red robes and arched yellow hats quietly took up position in front of the tomb. Down the hill, a pair of monks blew into their radongs, enormous telescopic horns that emitted a deep baritone hum heard all down the valley. As the low resonations wafted in the breeze, the lamas launched into a lengthy funeral prayer, incorporating drums, tambourines, and burning incense. At the completion of the ceremony, the lamas quietly filed off to the side as an old shaman took to the stage. The age of Genghis Khan was filled with mysticism, and shamanism played an important role in the nomadic lifestyle. The grizzled shaman, who had a flowing beard and was dressed in caribou skins, danced and chanted around a large fire containing sheep bones. With a shrieking moan, he blessed the Khan's remains, imparting them from the land of the eternal blue sky to an afterlife of conquering the heavens. When the service was completed, the granite sarcophagus was rolled into the mausoleum, then sealed with a 6-ton slab of polished stone lowered by a crane. The spectators would later all swear they heard a distant clap of thunder at the precise moment the tomb was sealed, even though there was not a cloud in the sky. Genghis Khan was at rest again in his beloved homeland mountains, and his tomb would stand forever as a cultural mecca for tourists, historians, and all the peoples of Mongolia. As the crowd began filtering out, Ivan Korsov and Alexander Sargov approached from the rear, where they had been seated with the Russian ambassador.
"I see you are as adept at sniffing out historic treasures on land as at sea," Sargov laughed, giving Pitt and Giordino a friendly bear hug.
"Simply a bonus for figuring out why somebody tried to sink the Vereshchagin," Pitt replied.
"Indeed.
By the way, we still have our joint research project to complete on Lake Baikal. The Vereshchagin will be repaired and ready to go next season. I hope you both will join us."
"We'll be there, Alexander."
"Just as long as there are no more seiche waves," Giordino added.
Korsov sidled up, his usual ear-to-ear grin in full display.
"An impressive demonstration of undercover work, my friends," he said.
"You should join the Russian Federal Security Service. There is a need for men of your talents."
"I think my boss might have a thing or two to say about that," Pitt laughed. The president of Mongolia approached with a small entourage. Sargov said a quick farewell as Pitt slyly noted Korsov melding away into the exiting crowd. A short, polished man of 45, the president spoke nearly flawless English.
"Mr. Pitt, on behalf of the people of Mongolia, I wish to thank you and your Numa team for rescuing Genghis for all posterity."
"A giant of history deserves to live forever," Pitt replied, nodding toward the mausoleum. "Though it is a shame that the riches of the tomb have all been lost."
"Yes. It is a tragedy that the treasures of Genghis were dispersed to collectors around the world simply to enrich the pockets of Borjin and his siblings. Perhaps our country will be able to buy back some of the antiquities from our newfound oil revenues. Of course, the archaeologists all believe that a greater trove lies with Kublai Khan, whose grave Borjin was thankfully unable to find. At least Kublai and his treasure still reside undisturbed in Mongolia, buried somewhere beneath these hills."
"Kublai Khan," Pitt muttered, staring at the mausoleum of Genghis. On its granite facade, he noted an engraving of a lone wolf whose outline figure was painted blue.
"Yes, that is the legend."
"Mr. Pitt, I wish to also personally thank you for exposing the corrupt activities of the Borjin family and helping put a stop to their lawlessness. I have initiated an investigation into my own government to determine the extent of the influence peddling on their behalf. The remnants of their actions will be buried with the body of Borjin. I promise."
"I hope that Tatiana is proving to be a cooperative witness."
"Most assuredly," the president replied with a furtive grin. Tatiana, he knew, was being held at a less than comfortable security site.
"With her help and the continued assistance of your oil industry companions," he said, nodding toward Teresa and Wofford, "we shall be able to exploit the discovered oil reserves for the good of a new Mongolia."
"China isn't going to renege on acceding Inner Mongolia?" Gunn asked.
"It's too politically dangerous for them to do so, both internationally and within the confines of Inner Mongolia, whose occupants largely favored secession from China."
"No. The Chinese will be happy enough, as we've agreed to sell them oil at a favorable price. That is,
until our pipeline to the Russian port of Nakhodka is completed. The president smiled and waved at the Russian ambassador, who stood a few yards away, chatting with Sardikov. "Just ensure that the oil revenues go to the people who need it most," Pitt requested. "Indeed. We've taken a lesson from your own state of Alaska. A portion of the revenues will be distributed to every man, woman, and child in the country. The remainder will support the state's expansion of health, education, and infrastructure. Borjin has taught us that not a dime of profits will end up in the hands of an individual, I can assure you."
"That is good to know.
Mr. President, I have one favor to ask of you. We discovered a plane crash in the Gobi Desert.
My director of antiquities has already informed me. We'll be sending a research team from the National University of Mongolia right away to excavate the aircraft. The bodies of those aboard will be returned to their homes for proper burial.
They deserve that."
"It was a pleasure, Mr. Pitt,"
the president said as an aide tugged at his sleeve. He turned and started to walk away, then stopped.
"I almost forgot," he said to Pitt. "A gift from the people of Mongolia to you. I understand you have an appreciation for such objects."
He pointed down the hill to a large flatbed truck that had discreetly followed the funeral procession up the mountainside. A large covered object sat upright on the truck's bed. As Pitt and the others watched with curiosity, two workmen climbed up and pulled back the canvas covering. Underneath sat the dust-covered Rolls-Royce from Borjin's compound.
"Should make for a nice restoration project on the weekends," Wofford said, eyeing the decrepit car.
"My wife Lauren will love that," Pitt replied with a devious grin.
"I'd love to meet her sometime," Teresa said.
"Next time you were in Washington.
Though I take it you'll be working in Mongolia for some time to come."
"The company gave us 3 weeks of paid leave for our ordeal. We are both hoping to go home to rest and recuperate before Jim and I come back."
From the look she gave Giordino and the tone in her voice, it was clear that the "we" was not referring to Wofford.
"I don't suppose you could take it upon yourself to nurse a rabid old sea dog like Al back to health during that time," Pitt offered.
"I was rather counting on it," she said coyly.
Giordino, leaning on a crutch with his lower leg heavily bandaged, smiled broadly.
"Thanks, boss. I've always wanted to see the Zuider Zee."
As the friends parted company, Pitt strolled down the hill toward the flatbed truck. Gunn joined him as he approached the old Rolls.
"The Mongolian energy minister just told me that the price of oil is down another $10 today," he said. "The markets are finally accepting the news that the Avarga Oil Company has been put out of business for good, and the destructive earthquakes are finished. Combined with the news of the oil reserves in Inner Mongolia, the experts predict that the price will soon drop to levels below those seen before the Persian Gulf disruption."
"So the oil panic has subsided and a global depression averted. Maybe the economic powers that be will finally learn the lesson and focus on developing renewable energy sources in earnest."
"They won't until they absolutely have to," Gunn said. "Incidentally, I was told that the Pentagon was none too happy that all three of von Wachter's seismic devices were completely destroyed after the last known device was sunk in the Persian Gulf."
"Numa can't take responsibility for that one."
"True.
It was a lucky stroke that Summer and Dirk stumbled upon Borjin's brother and the second device in Hawaii. Or he stumbled upon them. Had the ship traveled on to Valdez and damaged the Alaska pipeline as planned, there would have been real pandemonium."
"It was the Chinese wreck Summer found. It drew them there for some reason," Pitt said.
A faraway look crossed his face as he mentally searched the clues. Then his green eyes suddenly sparkled in enlightenment. Gunn was oblivious to the mystery, focused instead on the immediate demands of his government. Not only were all of the seismic devices destroyed, but von Wachter's research materials as well. Apparently, Borgin had all of the professor's data in the laboratory building, which is now a pile of charcoal. There's nothing left for anyone to be able to resurrect the technology. Is that a bad thing? I suppose not. Though I'd feel better if I knew the knowledge was in our hands and not the likes of Borgin. Just between you, me, and the car, Pitt said, I happen to know that the operator's manual you lifted from the lab survived the flood and fire. The manual survived? It would give a big leg up to anyone trying to duplicate von Wachter's work. I hope it's secure. It's found a safe and permanent home. You sure about that? Gunn asked. Pitt walked to the rear of the Rolls and opened a large leather trunk mounted to the car's luggage rack. Lying at the bottom of the musty interior was the seismic array operator's manual, with the shaft from the crossbow arrow still protruding from its cover. Gunn let out a low whistle, then put his hands over his eyes and turned away. I never saw it, he said. Pitt latched up the trunk, then casually inspected the rest of the car. Overhead, a bank of dark gray clouds began moving in rapidly from the west. The remaining mourners milling about the tomb quickly headed toward their vehicles parked below to avoid the pending deluge. I guess we better be on our way, Gunn said, steering Pitt toward their rented jeep down the hill. So, it's back to Washington? Pitt stopped and stared at the mausoleum of Genghis Khan one last time. Then he shook his head. No, Rudy, you go on ahead. I'll catch up in a few days. You staying here a bit longer? No, Pitt replied with a faraway twinkle in his eye. I'm going to hunt a wolf.